Talk Radio 790 KABC. Peter Tilden at 10 continues. Hour number two, brought to you by, of course, Larry Miller and Sit and Sleep. It'll be anyone's advertised price, or your mattress is free. We got tickets to see Frankie Valli and a symphony orchestra. I'll tell you when to call. One of the big news stories of the day is Russia and the fact that we have basically said to 60 Russians, you're out, expelled 60 Russians, more than 30 from across Europe. I wanted to get some context on that and find out where we are with Russia, what do they want at this point, and what's their retaliation going to be. So joining us now is Dr. Robert English, Deputy Director of the USC School of International Relations, Associate Professor of International Relations, and author of several books on Russia and U.S.-Russian relations. Good morning, Robert.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So we have now expelled 60 Russians from the United States. More than 30 have been expelled across Europe in response to this March 4th poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter in Britain. And we've had espionage feuds between Washington and Moscow in the past. You can look up a history of that. But I just wanted to get some clarity from you and for our listeners of where we're going, what we're trying to accomplish with our relationship with Russia at this point. And what do we need them for? What do they need us for? What shared vision do we have? Just to get some sense of what the ideal relationship would be with them and why it's always been impossible to get there.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot to chew on. The big picture, in other words, what our ideal goals are for each other.
Sure.
I think, ironically, given how bad relations are right now, ideally, there is a shared vision. There certainly, at least, is a path to cooperation because we have these common interests in the world in fighting terrorism, in addressing regional problems, and larger issues like the environment that's looming, the problems in the Arctic, that are all pushed aside because of these day-to-day spats over regional issues, or now this spy case. How we get there, I don't know, because we are at a historic low. I am baffled as anybody on both sides, right? On the Russian side, this would seem, the assassination, to be such a counterproductive move, so against Russian interests, precisely because it's united the West against him. It's
right.
Really backfired. It's been an overreach. And why did they need to do it, right? This is somebody they had in custody. If they wanted to execute him for treason, they could have. They're making a strange point, but it's, you know, the benefits are far outweighed by the cost they're incurring. But on our side, Moscow looks at us with equal confusion when Trump says one thing, but then his State Department does another, when he congratulates Putin without any mention of these frictions one day, and then, you know, less than a week later, we're hitting him with these really difficult sanctions and maybe threatening further economic harm. So both sides have some reason for wondering what the heck the other is up to. And part of the answer is in the confused domestic politics of each country, the divisions at home in each country that lead to these sometimes incoherent moves where the executive says one thing, the legislature does another, the president goes one direction today and a different one tomorrow.
So when you're dealing with Russia, I mean, he's got to have a back channel to Russia. He's got to have diplomacy going on with people advising him. The question for me is this, like with the oligarchs, right now you can shut down a lot of wealthy Russians. And I was shocked to see, I don't have it in front of me, that there's more Russian money outside of their country than there possibly is inside their country. So if you start shutting down oligarch money, isn't that actually a good thing for Putin? Because he can repatriate some of the money. And I think what they're doing now is they're saying, if you bring your money back into this country, we'll lower the tax rate, we'll make it attractive for you to return your money back to Russia. So when you hear they're going after oligarch money outside of the country, you think it's a bad thing, but doesn't that end up helping Putin in some way?
It may. That's a very indirect route, and in all likelihood, a lot of that money will stay abroad simply because whatever incentives Putin applies or that we add to with our sanctions, there is still so much more money to be gained, so much more security in holding your money in Cyprus or the Swiss bank or what have you. It's just, there's just so little faith in the long-term Russian economy. But there's another problem here in that next round of sanctions. Legally, when you go, as you say, after oligarchs, and that's the expression, I know it's not yours, but that's the one that congressional authorities
right.
and others have used. On what basis? In other words, just because we know that there must be sleaze behind this and they're dirty businessmen, There's no legal process there. How were they singled out? Is it because instead that there's a perception that they're close to Putin? Well, maybe, but unless you have some concrete evidence of wrongdoing. For example, those who have previously been sanctioned, right, for concrete actions taken in support of the annexation of Crimea.
Right.
Or, let's say, the brutal treatment of Sergei Magnitsky and other human rights defenders in the country. Those, you have a concrete legal case for this person did wrong, therefore they're being sanctioned. But if the U.S. starts going after wealthy businessmen who have shady, maybe close connections with the regime, but we're not quite sure what they are, Putin likes them, they've been seen together at a banquet, well, then you're on a really slippery slope because there are a lot of Saudi businessmen and a lot of Venezuelan and Brazilian and all over the world. So that would be going into gray area that we're very loath to do, and it could wind up hurting us as well, and our allies aren't so sure either. So that next step is not terribly likely.
The sanctions don't necessarily, I got you, it's not as easy as it sounds. It sounds like
that next round is harder to target properly.
They have a bravado over there where they don't want to let us know, or Putin especially doesn't want to let us know when sanctions are hurting them. I've noticed that they put out a lot of intel online where they do it with some humor. I saw something on Twitter, I think, where a woman is stopped, a cartoon of a woman in a car stopped by a cop, and she said, "I'm sorry, I'm speeding, I didn't realize it, but Russia had hacked my speedometer." You know, where they put out those kind of campaigns, you wouldn't know it's coming for them. How do we know when sanctions are hurting them, when the country is looking at Putin and saying, "You know what? Yeah, 17 years you've been in power, but we're not having a party over here." Is there a problem for him at this point with his people?
There is. And it's a new problem, and it happened just yesterday, and that is the tragedy in the Siberian city of Kemerovo. This is the fire in the shopping mall that killed over 60, maybe over 100 people, most of them children, in the most horrific and heartrending circumstances. And the reason I mention that is that at other junctures, responding to your question, yes, Putin can use mockery. His supporters can kind of whip up a nationalistic response or rally around the flag. When the Americans do this or the British do that, we're going to stand united and respond. This is a different time, right? The mood in Russia today is very somber. It's grieving, and it's sort of turned inward. And the focus is not on enemies abroad, but on enemies at home. And those enemies are corruption, their incompetence, the sloppiness and indifference of everybody from the, you know, top government officials responsible for public safety all the way down to the drunken guy who was supposed to check the fire alarms or the sprinklers at that mall, right? There is no taste right now in Russia for a campaign to somehow point the finger abroad. They realize, they've been reminded just with unbelievable cruelty and tragedy that there are bigger problems at home. And there's no foreign enemy to be blamed for this. It's their own incompetence. It's the all that I just described that they know is a homegrown cancer. So I, ironically, don't expect a rapid escalation of this diplomatic tit-for-tat. Putin doesn't need, and he's aware this will really hurt him with the public in a way that previous crises haven't. People are waiting for action from the leader now, and not another, you know, set of mockery or indictment of the West. Something really substantial has changed with this in Russia. And Putin does ultimately have to worry about public opinion. And it can't always be manipulated, you know, with social media.
How, you know, everybody looks at Putin as the guy. His tentacles are into everything, whether it's this Russian investigation. He knows, sees everything, makes every final decision. How overblown is that?
It is overblown. I don't know if I can say 50%, 75%, maybe it depends on the case. For example, the election meddling. I remain firmly convinced, and I follow the analyses here closely, especially on the social media side, the Facebook, Twitter, the bots, the Internet Research Agency paying people for this or that. And as best our analyses show, that was still a drop in the bucket compared to, you know, everything else that went on the campaign. It simply wasn't a primary factor in Donald Trump's election. A lot of what they did was wasted effort. I could give you example after example. For instance, the wasted money spent trying to influence public opinion by targeting Texas or California, states that were not in play, or how much Facebook effort was spent in the primary elections in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and not in the final. It was clumsy and amateurish. It was a serious breach at the same time and cause for concern in the future were it to grow more sophisticated. But this, Putin wasn't 10 feet tall. He didn't put Donald Trump in the White House. And the same is true around the world, right? The meddling in European affairs, in the same fashion, in British elections, in Austrian, the Europeans know that it's not the main factor. They know that the surge of populism and right-wing authoritarian leaders, especially in Central Europe, is because of the economy. It's because of mistakes that the European Union has made, and above all, it's because of the surge of refugees from the Middle East that have overwhelmed those countries, not because of Russian social media. So, yeah, we take our eye off the ball if we blame everything on Putin, and then we ignore the real causes of some of these problems that are fracturing Western unity.
Dr. Robert English, we're talking to him. He's an expert on the politics of Russia, the former USSR. What is Putin's long game? Do we know at this point? And is he kind of stunned with how the Middle East is playing out, how the United States election is playing out, and like you said in our opening discussion about the sanctions and how there's a disconnect between sometimes what the president says and what the actions are? It looks like we're going to be as tough on Russia as anybody has been, any past administration has been.
Perhaps, or maybe the Trump administration felt they had to do this and probably quietly warned the Russians it was coming. But at the same time, you have the Donald Trump who's congratulating Putin on his reelection and looking forward to a summit meeting and addressing big issues like Ukraine and Syria. So they can't be sure which Donald Trump is here. But
could that be, by the way,
the apparent toughness could be just temporary.
I was going to say, could that be a good thing and a bad thing? Could that be a good cop, bad cop, where the president's reaching out to him like, we're trying to reset, do a reset with you. However, you keep messing it up, and I have an administration that is going to punish you.
And Congress has tied my hands. Even if I wanted to be friendlier, the stuff you're doing has so outraged members of Congress who can force me to sign legislation. I can't even veto it. They'll override it. So, yes, you're exactly right. That's a well-known diplomatic tactic, a two-level game where Trump says, Putin, you have to make concessions and moderate behavior, because if you don't, my hands are tied and I have to take action. But I want better relations and I want to work on these big issues. So there could be method to the madness. We don't know for sure. On the Russian side, you ask about Putin's long game, and that's a term that I use with trepidation because it's changed over time. Putin is primarily an opportunist and he reacts, but we don't see as much strategy as we do tactics. The Putin of the early 2000s, who was reforming, who was taking liberal market-oriented measures at home and basically doing progressive things, disappeared for the Putin of the later 2000s, who's building up Russian strength and pushing back against the U.S. and NATO expansion. And when Crimea happened out of the blue, right after the Sochi Olympics, it seems like it came in kind of a spasm of anger because of the revolution there. So he's reactive. He'll take what gains he can get. He'll push and prod until the West pushes back, which it is now. But I don't fear that he wants to or is capable of undermining the West and our democracies and ending the liberal order. Again, that's attributing to Putin far more talent, ability, and reach than he has.
How does the favorability of the citizens of Russia toward America, how's that changed? How's he been able to foment change there, and is he successful in it? Because I see that polls over here show that in 25 years, the Gallup polls have changed from 92 to 2017. 62% of American respondents had a favorable view of Russia in 92. Mm-hmm. 70% of Americans now have an unfavorable view of Russia. So that's a huge swing.
Some of that is successful persuasion of people that the U.S. is behind, Russia's isolation, Russia's difficulties in the world, that the U.S. is encroaching. We are pushing NATO to expand and build bases around their perimeter and so forth. But part of that we have foolishly caused ourselves. And I have to point the finger less at the Bush administration and more at the Obama team, because Obama and Hillary Clinton were sloppy as diplomats. And as much as you criticize Russian policy or push back against Russia in the world. You shouldn't personalize politics the way those two did, comparing Putin to Hitler and mocking Russia as a declining regional power. Clinton and Obama, for all of their other positive features, were a little bit amateurish and petty in their foreign affairs and dealing with Russia. And that played right into Putin's hands, right? It wounded their pride. All the years of the Cold War, right? Nixon, Eisenhower, Kennedy, for all their tough positions toward Russia, they never personally made fun of Russian leaders. And I don't understand why our leaders descended to that in the last administration and a little bit in the one before. But that has unnecessarily aggravated relations, and it's made it easier for Putin to paint the West as an adversary when we are so petty in our politics.
Dr. Robert English, thank you so much for giving us insight. We'll use you again, I'm sure, because this is not going to go away.
No, it won't.
and you're fascinating, your response to them retaliating and being sidetracked now by domestic problems at home, huge domestic problems at home. Dr. Robert English is a deputy director of the USC School of International Relations, associate professor of international relations, and author of several books on Russia and U.S.-Russia relations. And thank you so much last minute for coming on. Really appreciate
My
it.
My pleasure.
Take care. Have a great day. And we'll be back. Talk Radio 790 KBC. Talk Radio 790 KBC. Peter Till and the 10 continues. And you know what? Frankie Valli, big talent. Tons and tons of hits. If you call now, I'm going to send you to see Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons and the Pacific Symphony Orchestra at the Pacific Amphitheater, July the 12th. So call right now, 800-222-5222. Dino's trying to either show me his mental age or he's holding up 10 fingers saying, make it the 10th caller. All right, we'll make it the 10th caller. 800-222-5222. You're the 10th caller. You're going to go see Frankie Valli. Call quickly and good luck with that. By the way, Mark Zuckerberg, CEO Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, is going to Congress. Remember he said, well, I think the best person, we'll figure out the appropriate person to go. Well, Congress wants to see him. And it looks like, because on Capitol Hill, both sides of the aisle want to hear him. It looks like he's now coming to terms with the idea that he's going to have to testify before Congress sometimes over the next couple weeks. They're planning, what they're saying, quote unquote, is they're planning the strategy. Now, that is code for we're sending a blank load of lobbyists and lawyers to Washington right now to determine ahead of time what questions he will be asked and not be asked, or everybody in Congress's Facebook will not be working, shortly after he testifies. So this is pretty interesting. It's a lot further than he wanted to go. I don't think he wanted to testify about his company and how they decide what you see and what the algorithms are and how they protect us from fake news and on and on and on. But it's going to hit. He's got to do it. He said, I'm happy if it's the right thing to do. Facebook testifies, by the way, in front of Congress a lot of times on a lot of topics, some high profile, some not. But what they're doing now is they want to see the head guy. They want to make him accountable because he's the head poobah. And if you get any sense of him, man's worth $54 billion. He does not want to testify in front of Congress. He puts on that everyman thing with the hoodie and whatever. It's worth $54 billion. He looks down at these folks and thinks they're idiots. I don't want to go there. But guess what? He's going to have to testify, and maybe we'll find out a little bit more how Facebook operates. And by the way, call me if you've deleted Facebook. If you're off of Facebook because of the last couple weeks of the news you heard, I'd love to hear from you. 800-222-5222. Do that in a couple minutes because all the lines are lit right now for the Frankie Valli thing. But we're going to talk about that. And I also want to talk about stoned driving. How much marijuana, if you're honest with me, I'd love to talk to people who are smoking and getting high and using pot. How much marijuana is too much marijuana where you won't get in your car and drive? Or can you even tell if you're high enough not to drive? Remember, we don't have, in California right now, we don't have a way to detect this. We have drug recognition experts, but I guess that's kind of a subjective way to test. And THC in your system doesn't immediately mean you're high or that you are impaired. So I love to know from folks who do get high, how do you maneuver your day? Do you Uber it? Or do you not know you're high and it's one of those, oh, Peter, it doesn't matter. I can smoke and it doesn't infect. It doesn't impair me. I'd love to discuss that next since we don't have a standard yet. We don't have any kind of standard. And we do have this Draeger drug test 5000 I can tell you about. But that, I don't think that's going to do it either. So we'll talk about driving intoxicated from pot when we return here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
KABC News is live and local at 11:30. I'm Jeff Whittle, and a man died in an overnight house fire in Rancho Palos Verdes. A mother and her adult son were rushed to the hospital, but the son didn't survive. He's identified as 48-year-old Craig Kelly Burns, who is bedridden, and his 87-year-old mother, who has lived in that home for over 40 years, suffered smoke inhalation. Gracie Antolo spoke to NBC4 News about her neighbors.
I know the family for so long, and I know the boy. My heart is broken for him. I can't take it anymore. Really good people.
The cause of that deadly blaze is under investigation. A pedestrian was struck and killed by a vehicle in Fullerton at Brookhurst Road and Valencia Drive around 6 this morning. The driver remained at the scene and was interviewed by Fullerton police, who have not released any information on the gender or identity of the victim. Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg has decided he will testify before Congress about the way the social media giant handles its users' data. Sources tell CNN Money the 33-year-old Zuckerberg's come to terms with the fact he'll have to testify on Capitol Hill within a matter of weeks. So Facebook officials are now planning the strategy for his testimony. Zuckerberg has rejected calls from British lawmakers to testify before them. Disgraced sports doctor Larry Nassar's former boss at Michigan State, ex-dean William Strample, has been charged with 4 criminal counts, including 1 felony count of misconduct in office for allegedly abusing his power while he was head of MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine. The criminal complaint claims Strample groped women's buttocks at events and demeaned the way they dressed. And it must be time for 790 KABC Sports. The L.A. Kings shut out Calgary 3-0. The Ducks skate in Vancouver tonight. The Lakers lost in Detroit 112-106 to go 1-3 on their 4-game road trip. Clippers will host Milwaukee tonight. Angels dump the Dodgers 4-1 in Game 2 of their 3-game freeway series, which wraps up tonight at Chavez Ravine. And the Rams have agreed to a 1-year contract with Bad Boy defensive tackle and Ndamukong Suh. And that's sports on the home of the L.A. Kings, 790 KABC. Traffic, a market check, weather, and more till then at 10 next. KABC News Time, 1133.
In a strong way to my soul. Stomp it just like Jelly Roll. In a strong.
Talk Radio 790 KBC, Peter Thielen at 10, continues 800-222-5222. He's asking if you're honest enough to call me and tell me that you drive stoned. How do you know that you're not too stoned to drive, to get in your car? Because it's very different than alcohol, and now that it's legalized, you can imagine what percentage of people are out on the street stoned that think they're not impaired. Again, I was shocked when I saw the video of me driving after I got high. And the stuff that I got was pretty heavy duty. I was stunned at how poorly I did and how well I thought I did. I guess there are ways to detect if people are high for a cop, even if they're subjective. Bob Marley stickers all over your car is one way. When a cop is asking questions and you keep going, what? That's possible. When you're done the interview and the cop's letting you go and you ask, do you have a lighter? Dude, do you have a lighter? It could be one way to know it. A Bernie Sanders tattoo anywhere on your body could be a giveaway. A UC Santa Cruz sticker, possibly a good way to tell. Or the easiest way to tell is you smell like pot, because pot guys smell like pot. But I don't know, with this new subjective way of testing, I don't know if that even holds up in court. We got to get somebody, Joe, see if we can find out that answer, if it can hold up in court. Because if a police officer is pulling you over and it's subjective, totally subjective, he takes you in because he assumes that you were driving high, I'm guessing that that does not stand up, does not have a good way of standing up in court. The lines are still lit, by the way, with the contest people. So if you're stoned trying to get through, I know you're going to be a little bit frustrated. There's legislation. This was an interesting story. Especially as I'm getting older and I'm seeing people who are dying, getting terminally ill. But a new bill which gives terminally ill patients the right to seek drug treatments that are still in clinical trials passed a phase of the Food and Drug Administration's approval process, but they haven't been fully approved by the FDA. People are concerned that if you are in that state, your final stages of life, and maybe you're in hospice or whatever, you may not make the best decisions. Here's the deal. If I'm that close to death, give me anything that I need. I should be able to, if I can get it, get a drug that's in a testing phase that could possibly save my life. This is the law for people who are really, really sick, who exhaust every single treatment option and who can't enroll in a clinical trial. And I just went through this with a friend of mine that was horrible. He was going really fast, and we were trying to get him into a clinical trial, and he didn't make it, and he ended up passing away. So they're trying to let folks who are at that stage of their life get the drugs that they need and bypass the FDA safeguards on health of public safety, because you're already there. This law would eliminate the application requirements to the FDA, and you can go right around it and hopefully get the drug or have your doctor advocate for it. But what I love is the vote. The vote was taken, and I like all those people who voted against it. Why would you vote against it? You may need that drug if you're going down at some point in your life, or a family member may need it if you're going down. But the process, we went 267 to 149 in the House. Who are those 149 people? Who are these people, as Jerry Seinfeld would say, who would vote against being able to get a clinical trial drug if you know you're going to pass away anyway, if it's pretty, it's a fait accompli that you're on your last legs? Guess what? Give me the drug. The Food and Drug Administration approval process is not fully approved by the FDA. So you got to go through different stages. And they're worried that it can hurt the most fragile patients. But again, if you've given me a death sentence and I have exhausted every single treatment option out there, I should ask Dr. Drew about this when he comes in. What do you have to lose with this bill? You can have a doctor approach already, advocate for you, and approach a drug company directly. And I've talked about it with Dr. Kipper. But you're in an emergency time here. You know that you're going to be checking out soon. And they already, a lot of drug companies already have a compassionate use policies for access. And you have to sign a waiver saying that if this takes me out, I won't sue you. But this paves the way for a passing by the FDA and getting the permission. So I can't wait. If I'm dying, I can't wait to be accepted in a clinical trial. And a lot of times getting in a clinical trial really involves who you know or who your doctor knows. Or are you a VIP, or do you have any kind of celebrity? So all you have to do with this program would say, I get the risk. There's no one forcing me to do this, and I'm alert enough to make the decision. I know all of the risks. So if that's the case, I don't know why you would vote against this. It doesn't make any sense. But the U.S. House of Representatives passed a federal right to try bill on Wednesday of last week, leaving a lot of Americans wondering what this could mean for their health, of them and their loved ones. If it clears another couple hurdles, you will be able to try and find out what drugs are out there and being investigated and possibly get them for you. So if you're going through this, you should alert family members, friends, that this is available out there now, but it's only for final stage, where doctors are saying you have limited time. And again, we just went through a horrible situation with a guy who had thyroid cancer. And thyroid cancer is usually restricted. You know, it's usually, you remove the thyroid, you follow up with some treatment, and it's isolated to the thyroid. He had a very, very aggressive case, and it proceeded really quickly, and we made every call possible to get him drugs and get him into these clinical programs, and it just took too long to get through the red tape, and he passed away. So this seems like a smart bill. I'll ask Dr. Drew about it, but it seems like a smart thing, and I wonder who voted against it in Congress, but you should know about it. Talk Radio 790 KABC. Looking for some cross-talk. Talk Radio 790 KABC, Peter Tilden at 10, wrapping up, making way for Dr. Drew and Lawrence Yvonne, and Dr. Drew is here, and we were talking off the air about my question about how can you tell if you're impaired. With alcohol, you kind of get a sense of what's going on, and people don't want to risk it because of DUIs, but they don't have a way to determine impairment. So yeah, it's pretty subjective at this point.
It's subjective. The whole process is a little bit more art than science, right? Like, alcoholics come late. Their motor impairments, actual alcoholics, comes later. They don't have me. I have motor impairment immediately as soon as I drink something. I'm non-alcoholic. But the same thing with pot. Some people can kind of tolerate it for a while. But their impairment's the problem with that drug, and both of them, to be fair, alcohol and pot, is they lose insight into the degree of
depression. Bingo, which is what happened to me during the test.
And particularly, you know, pot, the big thing is the distance impairment, right? They don't see distances normally. And number two, when I've talked to law enforcement about it, they go, yeah, we just basically end up using the same test we use for any kind of impairment. But we appreciate the pot addicts because they go slower.
So
alcoholics speed up.
As my producer Joe said, you can always talk because it's a guy going 17 miles an hour to Taco Bell. Let me say congratulations to Charles in Santa Monica. Never won anything. He won tickets to go see Frankie Valli and the orchestra. Well, Four seasons. So cool. There you go. So what's on the show today?
But one more thing I want to talk about your show still. Yes. My show, we got all kinds of stuff. We got the homelessness. And we're talking to somebody from Orange County, hopefully the chairperson of the city council down there about what they're trying to do to clean that up. I've got a Georgia State representative who was cut off by Tucker Carlson on TV yesterday.
Oh, okay.
I've got Esther Valdez, an immigration attorney, to talk about that 2020 census and asking about immigration status on the census. But I want to talk to you about the end-of-life drugs.
Yes, yes.
There's zero reason why people shouldn't be allowed to do that. Forget for helping them. Help the rest of us, because we might get some untoward.
Yeah, so who voted against that?
It's insane.
There you go. All right. Talk with your 790 KABC.